This is Friday Forum. I'm Rachel Cobb for KGLP. I'm here with the CEO of the UNM Gallup Branch Campus, Dr. Christopher Dyer. Hello, doctor.
Hello. Yate. Buenos dias.
Today, at the very least, we're going to be talking about some issues surrounding water.
You know, there's an organization that I'm a member of, and it's under the banner of the National Council for Science and the Environment. This is an agency that is the premier environmental and policy organization in the United States and possibly the world. Annual meetings held in Washington in January cover all kinds of topics, but generally they have an overarching theme every year, like it would be a biodiversity in the environment, climate change in the environment, a disaster in the environment. This last year, the main issue was water and the environment, and I'm also the founding president of a subgroup called the Community College Alliance for Sustainability Education. UNM Gallup's a member, and so I had a session with my colleagues from around the country on water, health, and the environment, and each one of us talked about a variety of issues and programs and things that we're dealing with in our communities at our institutions around the country, and that stretches from Hawaii to New York to Florida. So it was a really great session, and my topic particularly was water, health, and the environment with the Navajo and other tribal peoples, because water, of course, as you know, is always something that we have as a precious resource in the highland desert that we live in, but also throughout Navajo Nation, water is a precious resource. And one of the things that's happened recently, and by recently I mean in historical times, over the last several decades, is there's been a decline in the growing of traditional foods. Traditional foods both at the Zuni Pueblo, at other pueblos, but on Navajo Nation. Part of that has to do with water itself. For example, there's been an ongoing drought in our region that has dried up a lot of the lakes. They've literally disappeared. Now, some of them now have water again, like McGaffey has got some water in it. But who knows how long that'll last. But particularly, when you look at a place like Tehachapi, Tehachapi has 1,000 acres plus of land that was traditionally farmed that is fallow. In other words, nothing is much being grown out there at this point. And it has a lot to do with a loss of water, both from rainfall aspect, but additional water from the lake that they had up there, which was used to, you know, water the crops. So when you lose your ability to create produce, corn, beans, squash, herbal medicines, and other things that are part of your vegetable use pattern, you, in fact, lose the dynamic to pass that on as a tradition. And so what's happened there is, in fact, people shift their food preferences to other things, things that are less healthy, that are less, good for your body, and in fact can create the pandemic problem which we have, which is a health-related issue here of diabetes. For example, we know at the Zuni Clinic recently we did a query, how many of your clients have diabetes-related illnesses? And it was close to 90% of the admits are related to diabetes, which is related to diet, which is related to the fact that the waffle gardens, which they used to have in Zuni, for example, are no longer there. They're no longer growing the things that they used to grow to keep their communities healthy and keep their people healthy. And so they've changed their diet. And with that, there's this, I think, genetic propensity for diabetes among Native American populations. This is something that's been established by physical anthropologists at Arizona State University, for example, working with the Pima Indians, where they actually found that they have certain kinds of genes which allow them to store food efficiently, but it also creates, you know, these diabetic surges and the pandemic we now have nationally of diabetes in tribal peoples. So water is the key to being able to grow things and grow things that are good for your body. At the present time on Navajo Nation, they have an informed and, I guess, wise leadership with Vice President Jonathan Nez and President Russell Begay, and one of their initiatives has a lot to do with the concept of self-reliance. We know in the economic climate that they're facing right now that there may be cuts forthcoming in social programs. And so one of the ways that they can combat that is to try to get people to think about how can we work and cooperate and collaborate together again. And so one of the better ways to do that is for people to collaborate in growing traditional foods. So this is something that's being brought forth as a new or renewed cultural value of the Navajo Nation, is to grow your own food and to do it with other people together. And most importantly, you make sure you're involving youth in that process. So right now, the whole concept of self-reliance for the vice president in part is related to collaborative growing of traditional foods.
This region, it's not alone in having these issues, but this region has not only some concerns of contamination of water tables from various kinds of mining, whether petroleum, coal, uranium, but there also is the issue of salts in the soil, mm-hmm. that if you're not using rainwater as your principal source, as would be the case with most lakes, and you're trying to drain the water tables in order to irrigate, you're building up salt in the soil, and it's just not a viable, sustainable environment. Are these some things you're talking about?
Yeah, this is true. So, you know, we've talked now about the good aspects of water, water used to grow food, which is healthy for us. But at the same time, we've had a we know historically that one of the outcomes of irrigation, improper irrigation or prolonged irrigation using groundwater with natural salts in it, is saltation of the soil. And what saltation does is it clumps with, you know, crystals around the roots of plants, and they will be stunted, they will grow very short, or they won't grow at all. And if you salt, you have a high level of saltation in the soil, that soil's productivity can reach zero, meaning it's not usable anymore. And once that's happened, it takes years and years and years for that soil to return to any kind of a useful state. Case in point, archaeologically, is the ancient civilizations of the Tigris-Euphrates. You know, in ancient Ur and places like that, they had extensive irrigation, and one of the things that they believe caused the collapse of civilizations in the southern part of the Tigris-Euphrates drainage was saltation of the soil from the Zagros Mountains. And that then did not allow for concentrations of people in an urban setting to survive and persist because their productivity from their agriculture dropped. The same thing to some degree has been happening in Napa Valley, which is basically the green, I don't know what we call it, a green belt, but it's a produce pocket, one of the key produce growing areas of the United States. And they've been experiencing that and working on solutions to that. That is something also that can threaten our crops here and threaten agricultural activities, whether they be traditional or large scale. So, for example, with the NAPI project with Navajo Nation, that many thousands of acres of produce that's grown out there, pollution is an issue, and pollution through saltation, but also through other things. Now, when we talk about water, you know, in the bad side, we have to look at the Animas River pollution event. And when that occurred, it released a lot of heavy metals and things that are fundamentally toxic to humans and other creatures into the water column. The problem with that is even though the water is not yellow anymore, those elements and a lot of those things will sink and bind with colloid sediments in the bottom of the rivers and the watersheds. And when there is a spate or a heavy flow of water, they can get re-suspended in the water column. And if that gets into crops and, you know, grow, you know, where we're growing things in the nappy region of those thousands of acres, which use water from various drainages attached to that, it can, in fact, result in, you know, I don't know what you call it, blackmailing, but it can result in the loss of the ability of those crops to be sold for human consumption, because now they have heavy metals in them that are bad for your health, and you wouldn't want that to happen. So that's an ongoing concern with Navajo Nation and other people in the area, that they get various pollutants. You get saltation, you get runoff from this mine disaster, also from the various tailings and things like uranium. Uranium dust in uranium mines can affect water supply, and that can also get into people. So that's an issue. Another thing that's happened is we've seen an increase in severe weather events. Now, not necessarily in the total amount of rainfall, but how that water comes. And when it comes in a large amount in a short period of time, it can create havoc. It can basically result in mud flows under people's houses. Those mud flows result in the buildup of mold, which can then suspend in the air and cause all kinds of respiratory issues for people. So that's an issue, and it's been happening in various parts of the res. Another thing is people getting roads washed out, or basically other places where their foundations of buildings are affected. And when the roads are washed out or they're saturated because the rainfall keeps coming over a longer period, then you can't even drive on those roads. They become so gutted and the trenches are so deep that the cars either slide off the road or they become impassable. So that's another issue, besides the fact that we have bridges that are at risk. So there are things that are happening that are weather-related with increasing waterfall in certain areas, particularly in the reservation, that are creating secondary, what we call secondary disasters. Now, what is a secondary disaster? A secondary disaster, what's followed in terms of human impact on a community after the primary event. And in this area, we're talking about people being cut off, not being able to get around, losing ease of transportation, having these other diseases come from things that are water-related that affect their homes. And interestingly, we also get other increase in other things like hantavirus. And even, I know this is extreme, but bubonic plague. Now, what are the social consequences of that? The social consequences of that in terms of health are the fact that as people become isolated and then become cut off, they get depressed. And we know that the end game in terms of depression can be suicide. So it's no big surprise that in the areas where we've seen severe weather events, with loss of transportation, with other kind of secondary health effects, we're also seeing a rise in these other diseases as well as suicide rates. And they're all kind of, it's all kind of tied together. So, you know, that's in the bad and good of water. Water can be very helpful. We want to make sure that we can use it in a way that's going to be productive. And one of the thoughts we've had in that line, instead of thinking in the bad, is the water project, you know, coming down from the Four Corners area. You know, having the water pipeline down here, one of the discussions has been the concept of water banking. Now, water banking is related to being able to draw off some water and then use it in a way that's very effective in the growing of crops in a particular area. So it's no, you know, surprise that people might be interested in looking to Israel and seeing what they've done in terms of dry land agriculture, where they use drip irrigation techniques. So if you're able to bank water and use drip irrigation techniques, you can grow things back that you used to grow, traditional foods, but you don't have anymore. So I think as the pipeline is extending south and as people are talking more and more, how do we do this, that, you know, water banking, drawing off some water and keeping it, and then using dry land agricultural techniques may be the way to go. Now, another thing has to do with crop systems themselves. We know that there are the, what we call in Mexico, the tres madres, corns, beans, and squash. But there are a lot of other crops and different kinds of squash and pumpkins and different kinds of plants which are not only medicinal but provide food value. One of the places that they've been experimenting with this and encouraging that is at the Hubble Trading Post. Hubble has for years now had the farm systems set up around their perimeter, and they've grown all different kinds of crops. Many of that are traditional, some of which people were like, huh, we used to grow that? Yeah, they brought back the idea that these are things that we can grow and eat. Now, one of the problems, again, with growing things is getting re-engaging the imagination of youth that this is something you can do. This is something that you can add to a mixed economy you might have. to a household economy, even as in some cases part of a economic strategy to grow things again. But as we all know, anything that involves agriculture is hard work. It involves being outside. It involves getting wet and dirty sometimes. It involves physical labor. And that's a thing that getting people used to, and back to the idea, particularly our youth, that, hey, I can make a living doing this. It might not be fancy and you know, kosher in some circles, but it's a way to survive and it's a way to create healthy food products for our community. So they're looking into and have connections at Hubble with people who are into a variety of designer seeds or traditional seeds and plants that have been grown, you know, not only here in the Southwest, but other parts of the country, that could in fact be used and utilized to grow crops that will provide a good healthy mix. And so I think there is with the Department of Self-Reliance, there is an opportunity there to reconnect people to the land, reconnect people to land and water and the resources that will make bring back the concept of eating healthy. Now, that is certainly something that in the mainstream culture has become, I guess, fancy. It's something that people have accepted and think more and more of. The public are more, in fact, demanding that their food products are non-GMO, for example, that their food products are grown without pesticides or antibiotics or hormones, if they were talking about meat. So there are a variety of things that are happening in our mainstream culture. When you go to Whole Foods, that's the whole point, is everything is supposed to be healthy and grown without artificial chemicals or treatments. And we know that that's healthier for us. So the idea of this then spreading back into the cultures that used to live off of that. I mean, back 150 years ago plus, if you got meat and you were on the reservation, unless it was mutton or an occasional cow or something else of that nature, then they would be eating deer and they'd be eating rabbits, you know, venison and rabbits, wild rabbits. And that would, so meat was not something you had every day. It was an occasional addition to the diet, and the diet was basically vegetable-based. Now, that's been lost. I had a little shocker. The first time I came into Zuni Pueblo, for example, I stopped at the one place, the grocery store slash gasoline station slash general gathering place. I went in, and I saw an incredible display of chips of all different species. one of the largest displays I've ever seen. And then there were a few very sad-looking pieces of produce, none of which were native produce, you know, old apples and bananas and stuff, if you like that kind of thing. But the rest of it was very, you know, high fructose corn syrup, preservatives, salt, and other kinds of things that are not good for the human body. So it's getting back to where you were, I think that's important in terms of looking at water health and environment. And that's not only for our local Pueblos and Navajo Nation, but for all tribal peoples and frankly, for all Americans, as we try to reconnect to earth and look at the produce and the kinds of things that the healthy use of water can give us.
The health of the soil, so dependent on the health of the microfauna, the nitrogen fixers, and more. It's not just one organism we're talking about. And consequences of poor health in the soil is that you have a die-off of those organisms, and then you can't grow healthy food. You have some technologies which are more artificial, you know, hydroponics or what is sometimes called aquaponics, which could be useful in closed systems or relatively isolated systems, but maybe not so easy to implement on a large scale. So is there anything you can learn from technologies like that?
Well, yeah, I think certainly when you look at the dryland agriculture techniques, drip irrigation using PCB pipes and simple technologies, that's something that you can learn. There's some work being done with water filters for agricultural purposes, actually down at the University of Arizona, that could be very useful to eliminate potential pollutants that could then bind with the soils and get in the food crops as they grow up. So those are potential things. One of the things, of course, always if you're using aquaponics or hydroponics, is flavor. Because we often hear complaints that, yeah, I grew this giant tomato and it tasted like nothing. It was like a water, you know, with the tomato parts. So hydroponics is interesting, but you want to be able to make sure it's good. Another thing just to add about soils, which in terms of soils and water and runoff, which is a significant health threat in this country, has to do with areas where you have animals that are penned in large numbers and you're using a variety of chemicals and other things on them like antibiotics. When those get into the soil, they will kill off a large number of bacteria, often the healthy bacteria that you need to have a good soil. But what remains, that 1% or so that survives, then take over and they become superbugs. And so we're in many parts of our country at risk of creating the new wave of pandemics from soils where we're creating bacteria that nothing can kill, but they can possibly have severe health effects on humans and other animals. So we have to be careful with all of those kinds of things. Anything we put in the soil is bad. And as I say, what gets in water gets in us, because we are water. So we have to be careful as we use our water.
You know, as we discuss these environmental issues, the fact that a change in national administrations and that shift in Congress has led to the acceptance of the idea of essentially getting rid of the EPA and getting rid of more oversight from the national government, it leaves more responsibility on local governance, on local communities. How can that help?
Well, how can it help or hurt? I mean, if you're talking about large-scale systems like a significant watershed associated with a dam, and you have corporate entities who are producing large-scale amounts of produce, but they're using significant amounts of chemicals on those produce, those get washed into the soil and washed into the land. If you restrict or cut back on EPA regulations, or even not just the regulations themselves, but the policing of those regulations by hampering that agency and its ability to monitor, you're going to significantly have increases, I would predict, in health effects from things that are bad for you. It's no surprise that when you travel from New Orleans to Baton Rouge, and look at all those communities in between, that's called a cancer corridor. And it's because of what is in the water, you know, gets in the people. And, of course, everything that's put into the Mississippi drainage, as a big example, flows downstream. And it gets concentrated and biomagnified in organisms. And before you know it, it's in people and it gets in our adipose tissues and attacks our organs. One of the worst-case scenarios, I guess, historical examples of that has to do with the community of Pigeon Creek. Pigeon Creek is south on the Pigeon Forge River, and there was a Champion paper mill there that was there in the early 1900s, and the substance that's used, at least was used early on to bleach paper to give it that white appearance, was dioxin. Now dioxin is one of the most pernicious cancer-causing agents that humans have ever created. It's just as bad as putting a piece of polonium in your pocket, so to speak. Dioxin also is a wonderful at being biomagnified, meaning when it starts in the little organisms, they get eaten and it gets into the larger organisms, and then you've got fish eating those, and it's biomagnified, meaning it's increased in its focus and concentration, and then people eat the fish. Well, in this one community, people were getting cancer left and right, and they were also using the water from the watershed to water their vegetable gardens and then eating those. So they found dioxin rates that were, you know, hundreds of times above what was, quote, acceptable levels. And people were getting every conceivable and imaginable cancer. You can, every single organ in every single form was there. Now, they thought, at least initially, the mythology of that for that community was, well, we're just genetically, you know, backward and poor, and that's why we're getting all these cancers, because, you know, we are who we are. Well, that wasn't the case at all, and that myth was shattered when people started moving in to replace the people that, in fact, died from other places who were not part of that historical population, and they got cancer as well. So we know that that clearly was one of the worst cases of waterborne disease created by a chemical that we put into the environment through industry. So as we roll back the Clean Water Act and we roll back the Clean Air Act, I don't see anything good coming from that. And if community A wants to monitor their air and water, and community B is upstream from them, and community B has a significant investment in, let's say, coal-related or uranium-related industry, the downstream community doesn't have any recourse except to be impacted by those pollutants going downstream, either through the air or through the water. So you can't do it in a community-by-community basis. You need to have regional plans that involve whole watersheds, and that means federal mandated control and guidance and support, fiscal support, to be able to carry that out, because individual communities simply can't do it.
And it sounds like that cancer corridor, if you treat it as should be the case, the entire region becomes a super site, an EPA super site, and that never happened, of course.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, people, you know, there are still super sites all over the country. We have a super site cleanup fund, which is getting depleted rapidly, and that still the techniques of cleaning up aren't very good. I mean, Navajo Nation, for example, has funding for hazardous waste disposal and management. The thing about it they don't have is they don't have, I think, the sufficient technology as well as people trained to use that technology to be able to use those monies to clean things up. So you still have a significant number of problems. So, for example, in places like the Bennett Free Zone in Western Navajo land that have a lot of pollution events and people who are at risk. I remember there was one house they talked about, and for some reason the person who built the house had built it out of blocks that had been somehow embedded with uranium dust. I'm not sure exactly of the facts, but basically the whole house glowed, so to speak, and the people in it. And uranium dust, when it gets in your lungs, if you're not properly treating mines and sealing them, it can go for miles and miles and miles, and it can affect people who suddenly get lung cancer, and they don't know why, because maybe they were healthy and never smoked, and now they have lung cancer. So there are a lot of issues that have to do with us recognizing that environment is a system, and it's connected. The water is connected to the land, is connected to the food, to the bacteria, all of that. And by just trying to, you know, ignore one piece or push back something, we are threatening the whole system. We really can't afford to do that as a nation.
Really, the seriousness of recent discussions nationally and cutbacks on funding of science generally raises great concerns. It's not just the EPA we're talking about. It's that any dissenting voice, even if the data supports it, is underfunded to further a particular agenda.
Yeah, and if you're if you happen to work for a federal agency, such as, let's say, U.S. Department of Agriculture, or, you know, the Forestry or National Resource Conservation Service, there are musings or things that are going on where people are being told not to say certain things or not to promote certain ideas. That's contrary to the public interest, and that's contrary to science. I mean, I know people who work for the Department of the Interior, not in this administration, but a couple of administrations ago, and they actually resigned because they were being told basically to fudge their science and to ignore things that were obvious to them about what was happening in the forest with the rivers, with the animals, with the birds. You know, case in point, the birds in the Southwest, the smaller birds, they're starting to disappear. We're losing species because it's so hot that they, in fact, die from that stressor and aren't able to survive through the summertime to reproduce. So that's something we should all be concerned about.
We are in the sixth mass extinction, which ultimately may include the demise of humankind itself.
Well, yeah, in the last, I guess we could say half century, 50% of all the species on this planet have become extinct. And there is only, as Pogo said in his cartoon, we have seen the enemy and he is us. And that is something that, again, needs to be factored into economic equations, needs to be factored into how we use our land and water, is that if we decrease biodiversity, plants and animals that are our partners on this planet, then we are threatening ourselves in the long run to the point of human extinction. So at what point do we draw the line? I mean, there has to be an increased consciousness and awareness of the importance of the relationship between people and their environment, not only here in the United States, but globally.
I think more so than ever, you can no longer separate politics from science, because every scientific study, every new fact uncovered impacts a worldwide discussion.
Yes. I wouldn't want to be in a government post in Florida right now, because if you are an elected official in Florida right now, at least from what I've been told, and I just, in fact, publishing something on that, which is an update of a book on disasters, and I did some work with EDA in Florida. You're looking at a situation where people are not allowed to say these two words because they're not. It's not supposed to exist. It's bad for business. Well, that's a very, very short-sighted, synchronic view of the world. Bad for business now, but what are the costs of billions of dollars now being spent on the increase in worldwide severe weather events? When you boil water, it gets hot. Any lobster knows that.
And the Great Barrier Reef is even closer to death. Studies out just recently point to an increased incidence of bleaching. Mm-hmm. We may not have it around, at least in its previous disposition, within just a few years.
Yeah. When we want to think globally, I've got a friend, and we're working with a group. We're trying to get started called Voices of the Global South. And the whole point of it is to recognize the things that are happening out of sight and out of mind of people in the Northern Hemisphere that are affecting those who can least afford it, the marginalized voices, you know, of vulnerability south of the border. And I mean south of the equator. So everywhere from Fiji to the Amazon basin to South Africa, we're seeing severe events that are affecting animals, they're affecting species, they're affecting water cycles, water and wind cycles. I wouldn't want to have to rely on my traditional garden in Fiji right now, for example, because guess what? It's been invaded by salt water because of sea level rise. So a tradition that's gone on for as long as people have lived in Fiji is now being lost to sea level rise, where now they're having to rely on foods that are imported from other places. You know, it's just a very sad situation. And though we're responsible, we are all as humans responsible for these events. And we can't ignore that just because we might be okay at some place in North America, that people south of the border are not okay and they're being affected, you know, very gravely by these things.
Now, if it turns out that cost-effective filtration, perhaps using graphene, mm-hmm. reverse osmosis, mm-hmm. which could not only convert salt water to fresh water, but may be able to help clean up the soil. The fact is, every new development is looked at by some business communities as, oh, that's the magic pill that justifies
our ability to make money hand over fist at the expense of the environment. We don't have to worry about that because there's going to be this magic fix that comes along. The fact is, you can't count on that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. I mean, technology is wonderful. Technology has solved many of our issues in terms of transportation and health and well-being. We are living better and eating better than we've ever done before. At the same time, you can push it to the point where there is no going back. When I served on the Gulf States Marine Fisheries Commission as their social scientist, I had a conversation with our economist on that commission, and we had a discussion about Chernobyl. You all know what happened at Chernobyl. There was a meltdown of a nuclear reactor, and it basically exploded a spume of radioactive material, which affected everything for hundreds of square miles and traveled all the way to Sweden and got in the milk of reindeer in Finland and in the upper part near the Arctic Circle. So it affected the lives of the Sami who relied on the reindeer. So his comment to me was, well, you know, Chernobyl, yeah, we got radioactive stuff, but we'll figure out an alternate use for it economically. Well, the point is that once you push an ecosystem past the no return point, coming up with alternate solutions is not cost effective. It costs so much more to bring back what you lost, and you may never get it back, than it does to, in fact, say, well, that place we can't use anymore. So we may be, in fact, creating and destroying places we can use and live on the planet and reducing the area of habitable land and resources that are available to humankind.
In some sectors, there is this phrase, if you were raised as a Christian, you understand, but it applies anywhere in the world, and that is that at some point there needs to be a come-to-Jesus moment at which you realize you can't continue another day, another week, without jeopardizing the health of the planet. And we've essentially passed that point.
Yeah, unfortunately. I have a friend, his name is Walter O'Shell, and he's over in San Diego, and he and I actually taught together at the School for Field Studies site in Cairns, Australia, which is a paleotropics jungle. And it was a great, great fun to work with this world-class scientist as a teaching colleague. But one of the things he said to me that struck me, he said, well, he has got to set up a thing of what we call eddy covariance towers around the Pacific Rim. And these 24/7 are measuring all kinds of environmental variables. It goes into the soil and up into the atmosphere, his real-time camera. And he has graduate students collecting this data and using it for their dissertations and their master's degrees. And one of the things he said to me is, you know, a lot of my graduate students, they're really depressed. And I said, well, Walter, why are they depressed? Because they're seeing the writing on the wall. They're seeing what the data is showing them. And what is showing them is a scary proposition. We have created these models that are supposed to predict what will happen and is happening to the planet with climate change. The problem is every year we have to throw them out, or every 6 months, because the fact is that it's accelerating exponentially in a way that wasn't predicted. And things are accumulating faster and faster and faster. So it may be in some cases that we have passed the point of no return. I would be very concerned if the Greenland ice cap melted completely and what that would do to the Gulf Stream. Because if the Gulf Stream stops flowing, Europe will become an ice block. And, you know, many parts of our country will, there'll be massive die-offs of marine organisms since there'll be no nutrient flow. So, you know, these are the kinds of things that we're facing coming into our century. And we all have to wake up and stop denying that we are doing this and that these changes are real and that they have to be dealt with. It's, again, wherever you happen to live and whatever you happen to do, if you're in your house and your home and you got your air conditioning and you got your nice car and your standard of living and you can go have a steak anytime you want, the walls are closing in.
What's truly scary is that the people making decisions in many parts of the world, including this country, at least on a national level, not only deny that any human involvement can affect climate change, but that climate change is happening at all.
Yes, that the denial of climate change is one of the most dangerous human thoughts that we can have. You know, my hope for the future, though, is here in the Highland Desert, here in where we live and work with our Native American peoples and many others who have come to make this their home, that we are able to find solutions to some of the problems facing us here, and that we might then be able to share those solutions and those benefits with others as a way to model a sustainable community, model a sustainable diet, model a sustainable lifestyle. So, you know, I think that the work we're doing with the Navajo Nation and with others here will hopefully bring benefits that can have an impact beyond where we live.
It's ironic that in this age when futurists and researchers working for NASA talk about the possibilities of terraforming Mars, that we are rapidly being faced with the exigency of terraforming our own planet.
Yeah, and there are some wonderful books written by E.O. Wilson, who's actually one of my mentors. E.O. Wilson is at Harvard University. He's a father of sociobiology. He's written a wonderful book called Biophilia, which means love of nature. He's been awarded, you know, identified as the naturalist of this century, the one who has been most responsible in making people aware of the loss of biodiversity. And I remember a little essay he wrote about an area near San Francisco and all the loss of biodiversity that was occurring just in the local habitats along the California coast. And it was kind of shocking. And the problem becomes is once you reduce the number of viable reproductive organisms of a particular species below a certain level, there's a no-go-back point where that population now is incredibly vulnerable to extinction. We can take our buffalo as a positive example. Back in the day when the buffalo were down to a couple hundred animals, you know, with Teddy Roosevelt around and everything, they stopped the slaughter of them. They took those herds and they allowed them to reproduce and grow back. Now we have many tens of thousands of buffalo. You know, we used to have millions of buffalo, but at least we're into the tens of thousands now. And we're also bringing back in places like Alaska, the forest buffalo, which are a unique subspecies of the buffalo, but they grow much bigger and I guess meaner too, because they're living in a forest and they have lots of wolves up there. So,
but the gene pool of the buffalo as a whole has irrevocably been changed.
Mm-hmm.
I won't say reduced, because there has been some intermingling which can strengthen that genome, but it will never be the same genome.
No, because you started with just a couple hundred when you were literally dealing with millions of reproductives. You know, when they were shooting buffalo from trains and cutting their tongues out, at one point, I can't remember, I think they said there's like 20 million buffaloes or more, that sometimes there'd be a population of buffaloes, a herd passing, and it would take all day for that herd to go by. So you're talking about hundreds of thousands of animals. Yeah, so once you reduce genetic diversity, you're in fact, you know, affecting the whole future of a species.
It's also a major concern. We talked about seeds. The importance of heritage flora and fauna, it cannot be overemphasized. Currently in the diet of most Americans is a very narrow gene pool.
Oh, yeah. And it's one of the people that I met with when we talked about health food and the environment, which was a couple meetings back. I had written this wonderful book on the loss of food diversity itself. And he was a proponent of increasing the use of different kinds of foods and explorations of different kinds of foods. In fact, he ran a restaurant, and this restaurant was specialized in serving people foods that they'd never heard of before and using grains and seeds and plants they'd never heard of before. So even here in our region, we know, and talking to, you know, people who are involved in medicinal practices, that there's been there's changes in the ecotones on the slopes of our mountain ranges, like in the Chuska Mountains, where many of the things that were traditional herbs and medicines are starting to disappear as there are changes in weather patterns and changes in temperature patterns. As we have hotter summers, that these things just don't do well and they start to disappear. So at some point, you know, those species also become extinct. It's not just animals, but many plants are also, we've lost, but are on the verge of becoming extinct.
And it's happening all over the world. And, mm-hmm. you know, to look at Mount Kilimanjaro and that entire ecosystem dying, it's just one example. We talked about the Great Barrier Reef. The fact is, it's not an isolated situation. The lack of water or changes in water or changes in temperature affecting water mm-hmm. are dramatically excising species across the planet.
I can speak to Kilimanjaro directly because as I was the Dean of Strategic Initiatives for the School for Field Studies. When I was there, I mean, one of our sites is in Tanzania-Kenya border at the foot of Mount Kilimanjaro. And we work with the Maasai there as part of the outreach that the School for Field Studies does. So the students would have projects. And projects, of course, with Maasai are related, they have to be, to cattle, right? Because that's their wealth. That's the basis of their economy. And the cattle there are suffering tremendously because as the snow cap is reduced on Kilimanjaro, the amount of flow of water during the seasons when it's most needed is reduced significantly. You know, you have your cattle basically drying up and dying of dehydration from lack of water or getting very, very thin because the plants are not being watered, if you will, in the riparian zone or zone around rivers and streams where that traditional runoff from the snow melt would fill them up. Now the snow is simply not there anymore. The ice is not there in the same quantity, so it's creating a great hardship amongst those populations to the point that many of them are leaving that lifestyle and they're forced to emigrate to the city as beggars and try to stay alive on the streets. But that's a last resort kind of thing, because if you give up your cattle, then your whole identity is lost.
I think this discussion has been ongoing, but one, I think, key point that can be made is that the time has long since passed when scientists and researchers can hope to make change by communicating their results only to their benefactors, only to the government, mm-hmm. and it has to go public. You can't restrict it because a lot of that will be buried if you do.
I read an article recently about a person who back in 1988 was what we would call a climate denier, and he said, the line of many of those groups of people who are, let's say, embedded in Washington with specific political organizations was, we need more research. We need more data. But frankly, the writing was on the wall back in the 80s. And here we are, what, 30-plus years later, almost 40 years later. And this person has now changed their mind. He no longer believes that this is just a hoax. As someone once said that, it was invented by some politician, you know, and it's not, that's just silly, and it's dangerous. So we really need to take the bull by the horns and recognize we have to do as much as we can, as fast as we can.
And fight the fake news.
Oh, yeah, fake news, it's wonderful. I mean, commenting on fake news is like commenting on, well, it's too hot today. It just is. It's there. And what are we going to do about it? We just have to keep pushing the truth and pushing the facts and pushing science and making sure that people understand that this is not somebody's opinion. 98% of all people, 99% of all scientists who have studied this phenomena know and do believe it's human caused by carbon dioxide emissions. It's very deceiving to the public when you put two people on a show, one of whom is a scientist in that small minority who's a climate denier, and then somebody who is clearly been doing research on it for decades and has data, and they say, well, you see, there's people out there, and scientists are saying that this is just all, you know, hoo-hoo-y, it's all fake. The problem is when you look over here, if you think about this as an iceberg, here's this one scientist, and underneath him is this huge iceberg of other scientists who are all coming to the same conclusion. While when you go over here, you're looking at maybe a wooden raft with a few sticks, and there's no iceberg at all. You know, there's no there. So that's very deceptive.
And this has been pointed out in national media, mostly by comedians, that if you want a fair representation, you have one person representing the climate denial side, and then you have a whole auditorium full of scientists representing the research in that regard. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, we have to be concerned with how better to improve science literacy among the general public. It's one of the major issues impacting the political climate across the country. It's one of the major issues impacting the decisions that are being made.
Yeah. Well, something that we're trying to do this summer, I hope we get pulled it off, is Seminole State College down in Florida, one of our members of CCACE, the Community College Alliance, that I'm the founding president of, and one of their researchers there has got money for STEM-H involvement of women in science, young women as scientists. So we're hoping that she has funding to bring some of her students over here, and with some of our students here then have a class about the ecosystems and the biologies of the Southwest and New Mexico, you know, but also put it in archaeohistorical context by visiting places like Chaco, and seeing what and thinking about what people were doing here in the past and what caused them not to be here anymore. So we're going to be doing a program, a special topics course with this group of young women from Florida who are going to come up here and interface with our students and visit various interesting sites around New Mexico. That should be fun. But, you know, we got to get the word out. And working with and educating our youth is absolutely crucial.
And in STEM-H, we're talking about science, technology, engineering, and math?
Mm-hmm. And H, of course, is the hospital piece. But that's, again, the health piece, which you kind of hard to separate that from all the others.
Anything else that you might like to share with our listeners today, Dr. Dyer?
Well, I do believe that we do have an opportunity through our campus and through working with Navajo Nation and others to have a broad general awareness about what's going on in terms of water and our environment, and to think back to what people used to do and then bring it forward into the present as a way to regain health and regain an appreciation and awareness of how precious the environment is that we are living in, and hopefully that we'll continue to live in the future.
I've been speaking with Dr. Christopher Dyer, who is the CEO of the UNM Gallup Branch Campus and a researcher in his own right. Thank you so much for coming by.
You're very, very welcome. Thanks for the opportunity.
That concludes this edition of Friday Forum. This segment with Dr. Christopher Dyer may be heard online at kglp.org. Just select the podcast button. For KGLP, this is Rachel Cobb. Thank you so much for listening.